Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Kim Mulvihill, host of CBS 5's Health Watch. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Atul Gawande, writer for The New Yorker, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital, and author of Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance. Dr. Gawande is a practicing surgeon and an accomplished writer, teacher, and speaker. His insights into the medical profession are unparalleled, and I have to tell you, there are not many physicians that I have read, my husband, who is a surgeon, has read, my son, who is a pre-medical student, has read, and my other two sons want to read. So it really is a pleasure to be here tonight. In 2006, Gawande received the MacArthur Fellowship, popularly known as the Genius Prize, for the fresh and unique perspective, clarity, and intuition in his written work and his energetic and imaginative approach to finding practical ways to improve surgical practice. His first book, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2002 and is published in more than 100 countries. His new book uses the high-stakes challenges that he faces as a surgeon to explore the universal struggle to perform well. Please welcome Dr. Atul Gawande.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. It's great to be here. And it's great to be sort of near a home for me. I'd gone to Stanford and came up to San Francisco constantly up Route 280 through that beautiful drive to come to rock shows and independent movies and all the things that I could discover outside of my small town in Ohio where I came from. Well, I come to talk to you a little bit about my book, read a couple of passages from it. But I wanted to tell you a little bit about what it's about and how it might be different from my previous book. In one way, they're just the same. It's another set of stories from medicine, medical stories that I hope are interesting and fun and dramatic or funny. But the other task here is quite different. I'd written Complications from the perspective of someone who was a surgical trainee, and I was trying to understand, why is medicine imperfect, and how do you learn when what you're going into is indeed imperfect, and you are always going to be fallible? Well, having finished my training 3 years ago, joined the faculty as a surgeon, I then found a new set of questions that were arising. And at the core of it was trying to understand how you actually get good at something like medicine. And what I began to realize is that medicine is a kind of performance. It is a performance with a fascinating set of attributes and conditions, one of which is just high risk, another of which is the idea that you are working with a whole lot of people, and it's not just you and your hands and what you might be able to do after all. But to try to convey what it means to be a performance so that you really understand it, I wanted to read to you a little bit from the very beginning of the book, when I describe a case that has never left my mind. Several years ago, in my final year of medical school, I took care of a patient while I was on an internal medicine rotation, my last rotation before graduating. The senior resident had assigned me primary responsibility for three or four patients. One was a wrinkled 70-something-year-old Portuguese woman who had been admitted because, I'm going to have to use the technical term here, she didn't feel too good. Her body ached. She had become tired all the time. She had a cough. She had no fever. Her pulse and blood pressure were fine, but some laboratory tests revealed her white blood cell count was abnormally high. A chest X-ray showed a possible pneumonia. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. So her internist admitted her to the hospital, and now she was under my care. I took sputum and blood cultures and, following the internist's instructions, started her on an antibiotic for this possible pneumonia. I went to see her twice each day for the next several days. I checked her vital signs, listened to her lungs, looked up her labs. Each day, she stayed more or less the same. She had a cough. She had no fever. She just didn't feel good. We'd give her antibiotics and wait her out, I figured. She'd be fine. One morning on 7 o'clock rounds, she complained of insomnia and having sweats overnight. We checked the vital sheets. She still had no fever. Her blood pressure was normal. Her heart rate was running maybe slightly faster than before, but that was all. Keep a close eye on her, the senior resident told me. Of course, I said. Though nothing we'd seen seemed remarkably different from previous mornings, I made a silent plan to see her at midday, around lunchtime, several hours before I would have seen her on my afternoon rounds. The senior resident, however, went back to check on her himself twice that morning. It is this little act that I have often thought about since. It was a small thing, a tiny act of conscientiousness. He had seen something about her that worried him. He had also taken the measure of me on morning rounds. And what he saw was a fourth-year student with a residency spot already lined up in general surgery on his last rotation of medical school. Did he trust me? No, he did not. So he checked on her himself. That was no two-second matter. She was up on the 14th floor of the hospital. Our morning teaching conferences, the cafeteria, all the places we had to be that day were on the bottom two floors. The elevators are notoriously slow. The senior resident was supposed to run one of the teaching conferences. He could have waited for a nurse to let him know if a problem arose with the patient, as most doctors would. He could have told a junior resident to see her, but he didn't. He made himself go up. The first time he did, he found she had a fever of 102 degrees and needed the oxygen flow through her nasal prongs increased. The second time, he found her blood pressure had dropped and the nurses had switched her oxygen to a face mask, and he transferred her to the intensive care unit. By the time I had a clue about what was going on, he had already had her under treatment with new antibiotics, intravenous fluids, medications to support her blood pressure for what was developing into septic shock from a fulminant resistant pneumonia. Because he checked on her, she survived. Indeed, because he did, her course was beautiful. She never needed to be put on a ventilator. The fever stopped in 24 hours, and she got home in 3 days. The question, then, that I'm interested in examining this book is, what does it mean to be good at something in which failure is that easy, in which failure is effortless? And the answer I found in looking at people who are really at the top of what they do, and institutions that are simply better than others at what they do, was not that people were smarter than anybody else. It wasn't genius that allowed them to be great at something. And it was something that was more than mere competence as well. If you asked Jamie Winshall, who was that chief resident I just described to you, he would know what most everybody knows if you're competent in medicine, how to diagnose a pneumonia and how to generally treat one. But there was something more he recognized, and that was what it was to treat that patient in that moment, in that place, with the resources and the people that you had, with all their pluses and all their minuses. We are used to turning to athletes, say, to teach us something about performance. And there's a lot you can learn from athletes about performance. You learn about hard work, and you learn about perseverance and the value of practicing. But I'm proposing a slightly unusual idea, which is the idea of looking at medicine as a place to understand performance. And that's because there are dimensions to be found in medicine that you won't find on a playing field. For one, of course, lives are at stake. And that's what makes any profession where you're taking people as your responsibility moral in nature. The second dimension is that medicine is dauntingly ambitious. We're proposing that we will try to provide the knowledge of science and skill that has been developed over centuries and make it available on an individual basis to every single person in the country. Indeed, every person in the world is our ideal. We also have a further dimension, which is that this is work that is not just an individual trying to carry it out. It's not enough that a doctor be good at technical treatment and diagnosis. You have to sometimes have hundreds of people involved in the care of even an individual person. And so, for example, you need all the nurses on the shifts coming through, taking care of a patient who's in the hospital for a few days. You have the engineer whose responsibility is to make sure that the oxygen flow coming into the tubing, going to her nose, is actually getting there, pure oxygen. You want to have the people who bring the lunch trays, making sure that they know clearly that they're giving the tray that doesn't have concentrated sugars in it to someone with diabetes, all the way down to the doctors. And then there's a further demand. Not only must you do this work consistently and reliably, with lots of people working together somehow, but you have to do it with humaneness, with gentleness and concern. Well, it's clearly then not just the stakes, but the complexity of medicine that makes it intriguing and also a little bit disturbing when you start getting down into the details. There's a sign of how hard performance is in medicine, and that is the fact that we have a bell curve. It's something we have a hard time acknowledging, but it's the idea that we have a wide gap between those who are great at what they do and those who are really at the bottom of the curve. And furthermore, that most of us are grouped in that broad, mediocre middle. What the public imagines we have is what I call the shark's tail, meaning that after 4 years of medical school, after all the years you spend in residency, some degree of experience, surely we must all be grouped around the very best outcomes. And if you have a conscientious, attentive doctor, a hospital with a good reputation, then surely we must all be grouped around the very best, tightly together, with a little bit of a tail for basically crappy doctors. And if we knew what we were doing, we would cut those bad doctors off at the knees and just get rid of them, and then we would solve all our quality problems. But in fact, what makes the troubles complex is that most of us are in a kind of undistinguished middle. And there are only a few who are remarkably doing better. And the distance from them to the rest is actually significant. And I'll give you a few examples. In my first book, I talked about one of the first operations I learned to do, which was a hernia repair. This is where you have a weakness in your abdominal wall and the insides start coming out. It's like a tear in a couch cushion with the stuffing coming through. You can sew it up, or you can put a patch on it, but one way or another, you need to repair it. I mentioned in Complications, a hospital in Canada, in Toronto, called the Schuldeis Hernia Clinic. They actually call themselves a hernia factory. Each doctor there does anywhere from 700 to 1,000 operations, just hernia operations a year, more than I as a general surgeon or other general surgeons usually do in our entire career. And the result is that they have a less than a 1 in 1,000 chance that after the hernia operation, you will have your hernia ever come back again. What is the national average for people who do hernia repairs? It's a 5% chance, a 1 in 20 likelihood that your hernia would come back. And how about down at the end of that bell curve? Well, it turns out that there are people and institutions that have a 15, 20% chance or higher that you have an operation with them and your hernia will come back. It's a bell curve. I'll give you another example, in vitro fertilization. This is the Wild West of medicine. You have in vitro fertilization clinics popping up everywhere. There's probably one in your neighborhood coming to you now. And couples go for help getting pregnant, of course. What is the likelihood a couple will achieve a successful pregnancy with in vitro fertilization? Turns out to range from 5% to 75%, depending on what institution you go to. And most places are clustered around the median likelihood of success, which is 45%. It's a bell curve. I could give you lots of examples of this, but I'm going to tell you about one that I found the most interesting bell curve, and that's the bell curve for cystic fibrosis. The reason I find cystic fibrosis interesting is because it's medicine the way we want all of medicine to work. Children with cystic fibrosis are born with a genetic disease that we have no cure for. And so we take care of those children. It's a disease, by the way, that gums up their lungs, interferes with their ability to digest food, and it is the disease they will die from someday. So we take care of those children in 117 focused CF centers, and they're high-volume centers of excellence. All of the people who participate in those centers are super specialists in the disease. They follow detailed guidelines, more detailed guidelines than we have for most of the rest of medicine, and they all participate in clinical trials. This is what we would love for everything that we do in medicine, isn't it? And yet even they have a bell curve, and it's a wide curve. The average survival for an American with cystic fibrosis in a typical center is 33 years. But at the best center, it's 47 years, a 14-year difference. And this is despite how wonderfully trained everybody is, how careful they're controlling the quality, how much they're trying to keep everybody on a regimen of careful guidelines. So I wanted to find out exactly why there would be this kind of variability. And so what I did is I described going to a center which was at the middle point, actually just below the middle, for the care of children with cystic fibrosis. And it's a center in Cincinnati, the University of Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And I went there looking for trouble, problems. They were kind enough to let me in. And I'll tell you what I found was a hospital with a great reputation. This is a place that routinely ranks in the top 10 of American children's hospitals. The polio vaccine, the Sabin polio vaccine, was discovered there. That's the oral polio vaccine we depend on for the global eradication of polio. The head of the Cystic Fibrosis Center is someone who had actually developed several of the guidelines that we depend on nationally for how to treat cystic fibrosis. And he had written the chapter in Nelson's Pediatrics, which is the textbook of pediatric care for many physicians. So why then were they not at the top? Well, one answer could be that, well, they have a great reputation, but what's the care really like? And so I went with the patients in clinic for a full day. And what I found was care just the way you'd want it, with attentive people, conscientious, who were very aware of the current knowledge and research in cystic fibrosis, who were devoted to their patients, and the patients were devoted to them. They felt well cared for. And yet there they were, in the middle. So then I decided what I needed to do was see a place at the top of the curve, because surely what they had at that place is a secret drug. Because how else to explain why they would be having 14-year longer survival there? Well, the top place turns out to be the University of Minnesota program in Minneapolis, run by a guy named Warren Warwick. And I went, and I found that they didn't have a secret drug. They were following the same guidelines that everybody else was following. They were using the same treatments, and they were getting different results. One explanation could be that the kids had a different genetic form of CF. But it turns out that they are not any more likely or any less likely to have the most severe form of CF, this one gene called the Delta F508 mutation. Their kids are just as sick there as they are elsewhere, and yet they survive longer. So I had a hard time trying to put my finger on what might be the difference until I spent a day in clinic there. And I wanted to read to you a little bit about what it was like to see a patient in clinic there, because it seemed that everything they did was the same in one sense, following the same treatment guidelines, and yet completely different. In the clinic one afternoon, I joined Warren Warwick as he saw a 17-year-old high school senior named Janelle, who had been diagnosed with CF at the age of 6 and had been under his care ever since. She had come for her routine 3-month checkup. She wore dyed black hair to her shoulder blades, black Avril Lavigne eyeliner, 4 earrings in each ear, 2 more in an eyebrow, and a stud in her tongue. Warwick was 76 years old, tall, stooped, and frumpy looking, with a well-worn tweed jacket, liver spots dotting his skin, wispy gray hair, by all appearances, a doddering mid-century academic. He stood in front of Janelle for a moment, hands on his hips, looking her over, and then he said, "So, Janelle, what have you been doing to make us the best CF program in the country?" She muttered, "It's not easy, you know." They bantered. She was doing fine. School was going well. Warwick pulled out her latest lung function measurements. There had been a slight dip. 3 months earlier, Janelle had been at 109% of normal. Her lung function indicated she was actually doing better than the average child without CF. Now she was at around 90%. That was still pretty good. And I knew from looking at the numbers in Cincinnati that some ups and downs are to be expected. But this was not the way Warwick saw the results. He knitted his eyebrows. "Why did they go down?" he asked. Janelle shrugged. Any cough lately? No. Colds? No. Fevers? No. Was she sure she'd been taking her treatments regularly? Yes, of course. Every day? Yes. Did she ever miss treatments? Sure. Everyone does once in a while. Well, how often is once in a while? And then slowly, Warwick got a different story out of her. In the past few months, it turned out she'd barely been taking her treatments at all. He pressed on. "Why aren't you taking your treatments?" He appeared neither surprised nor angry. He seemed genuinely curious, as if he'd never run across this interesting situation before. "I don't know," she said. He kept pushing. "What keeps you from doing your treatments?" "I don't know. Up here," and now he was pointing at his own head. "What's going on?" "I don't know," she said. He paused for a moment. And then he turned to me, deciding to take a new tack. He said, "The thing about patients with cystic fibrosis is that they're good scientists. They always experiment. We have to help them interpret what they experience as they experiment. So they stop doing their treatments. And what happens? They don't get sick. Therefore, they conclude, Dr. Warwick is nuts." But let's look at the numbers. He was still saying all this to me. He was completely ignoring Janelle. He went to a little blackboard he had on the wall. It appeared to be well used. He said a person's daily risk of getting a bad lung illness with CF is 0.5%. And he wrote the number down. Janelle rolled her eyes. She began tapping her foot. "The daily risk of getting a bad lung illness with CF plus treatment," he said, "is 0.05%. And he wrote that number down. "So when you experiment, you're looking at the difference between a 99.5% chance of staying well and a 99.95% chance of staying well. Seems hardly any difference, right? On any given day, you basically have a 100% chance of being well. But it's a big difference." He went to the board and chalked out the calculations. He said, "Sum it up over a year, and it is the difference between an 83% chance of making it through the year without getting sick and ending up in the hospital, and only a 16% chance." Now he turned to Janelle. He asked her, "How do you stay well all your life? How do you become a geriatric patient?" Her foot finally stopped tapping. "I can't promise you anything. I can only tell you the odds. And in that short speech, I realized was the core of Warwick's worldview. He believed that excellence came from seeing on a daily basis the difference between being 99.5% successful and being 99.95% successful. Many things human beings do are like that: catching fly balls, manufacturing microchips, delivering overnight packages. Medicine's only distinction is that lives are lost in those slim margins. And so he went to work on finding that margin for Janelle. Eventually, he figured out that she had a new boyfriend. She had a new job, too, and was working nights after school. The boyfriend had his own apartment, and she was either there or at a friend's house most of the time. So she rarely made it home to take her treatments. At school, new rules required her to go to the nurse for each dose of medicine during the day. So she skipped going. "It's such a pain," she said. He learned that there were some medicines she took and some she didn't. One she took because it was actually the only thing that she felt made a difference. She took her vitamins, too. "Why your vitamins?" "Because they're cool." The rest she ignored. Warwick proposed a deal. Janelle would go home for a breathing treatment every day after school and get her best friend to hold her to it. She'd also keep her medications in her bag or her pocket at school and take them on her own. "The nurse won't let me," she said. "Don't tell her." And thereby deftly turned taking care of herself into an act of rebellion. So far, Janelle was okay with this. But there was one other thing, he said. She'd have to come to the hospital for a few days of therapy to recover the lost ground. She stared at him. "Today?" "Yes, today." "How about tomorrow?" "We've failed, Janelle," he said. "It's important to acknowledge when we've failed." And with that, she began to cry. There are a few attributes to the people who are, and the institutions, that are at the top of the curve for what they do in something like medicine. One, and you saw this in Warwick, is that they have the capacity for diligence, attention to detail. And you saw it in the way that he dove down into Janelle's life enough to grasp not only that she was not taking her medicines, but then also why. The way the boyfriend played into her life, her job, everything else. And if you think that's diligence, you should see what it's like to go along with a World Health Organization physician as they traveled to the south of India in response to a single case of polio that had broken out when they thought it had been completely eliminated from southern India. He had to supervise the vaccination door-to-door of 4.2 million children in a 50,000 square mile area, and he had to do it in 48 hours. Anything less than 90% penetration would have meant that the vaccination was a failure. But he ran that campaign, he supervised it, was able to find and plug the holes to achieve a greater than 95% penetration in a place where the healthcare infrastructure didn't even work. And when you begin to see how someone does that, how work or a WHO physician actually does their job, as ambitious as what they're trying to do is, you begin to see what it means to really have attention to detail. A second attribute that these folks have is surveillance. Remember that the beginning of that office visit and the whole way it flowed all began with his looking at that one lung function measurement that she had. He has followed as the single most important thing that he tries to measure in all his patients how their lungs are functioning by this one measure, and he's been doing it since the 60s when he first entered practice. And he'd been reporting it, trying to follow it, and asking constantly, how do we make it better? Another example is the military and thinking about how did they succeed in saving so many lives in this war compared to previous wars? Well, in the Persian Gulf War, we had a 25% likelihood that a soldier injured on the battlefield would die. And in this war, it's less than 10%. And one of the things I show in the book and try to explain through some of the stories of what happens there is that their weekly effort to follow exactly how often people are wounded, and then whether they died, what their outcomes were, that effort weekly allowed them to find holes, failures, things that could be fixed. They recognized, for example, that soldiers weren't wearing their Kevlar. They would be coming in with heart and lung wounds that they shouldn't have been having if they had their Kevlar vests on. And they realized they weren't wearing their Kevlar. And so they held the commanders responsible for making sure that the soldiers wore their Kevlar always, even if it was 110 degrees outside, even if they complained about the 18-pound weight that they had to lug around. They also recognized that the transport time from the battlefield to the operating table was too long. And they did a kind of counterintuitive thing. They decided, well, we're going to move the surgeons and the nurses, the anesthetists, right out near the battlefield in tents. And because they had to be stripped down to what they could carry in a few Humvees, they had to actually forgo a lot of the technology we depend on nowadays. The orthopedic surgeons had no X-ray equipment. In order to find fractures, they had to find them by feel. But the process ended up saving more lives than we've ever saved in history from devastating wounds, people surviving damage that we always thought was unsurvivable before. It's part of what makes it so heartrending to see the scandal at Walter Reed and how those patients were cared for after they'd been saved. And you think about, why did that happen? And one of the reasons is they didn't have surveillance for how they were doing afterwards. They didn't ask 6 months later, 1 year later, how are these soldiers doing? Where are the failures? And how can we remedy them? And so instead, the failures began to be invisible or dismissed as, oh, that only happens once in a while. But of course, it wasn't. So besides diligence, besides surveillance, another attribute of those who were at the top of what they were doing in medicine is that they've learned to do right despite enormous obstacles to success, despite sometimes moral obstacles. That visit I described to you was, for example, a 20-minute visit. Warren Warwick functions under the same pressures that everyone else functions under, from insurance companies, from number of patients they have, from facilities and so on. But he's the head of a clinic that he also has wanted to keep up and running for many years. So he understands. He has to find a way to make it work financially. He has to get those patients through. Sometimes he has to bend the rules. Sometimes he has to just stay as long as it takes. But he's found a way to try to work around the obstacles because he's had a moral clarity about the demands of that job. And then the final attribute I would point out that he had is one that I think is under-recognized but gives us all the reasons why being in medicine and trying to do this job is actually a fabulous and amazing opportunity. And that's that he demonstrated a bedside ingenuity. That is, he recognized that there are little ways, even though he's functioning in a world of guidelines and algorithms and so on, he recognized that there were opportunities to make a difference by being creative at the bedside. And so he came up with that little idea of keeping those pills in your pocket and telling her to just take them at school, don't worry about the nurse, and thereby had her rebelling in order to live as long a life as possible. He also saw this in a larger way. He's one of 8 physicians who take care of the children in that clinic. And if he did a fabulous job, it would be diluted out if everybody else was doing a mediocre job. He needed to be the director of a center that could deliver this kind of care. And so he has a meeting a couple hours a week of everybody, every physician, all the social workers, the nutritionists, and so on. And they have to talk about every patient they saw that week, what their problems were and what they wanted to do about it. It's amazing if you think about it. Imagine if you went to a doctor and you got not only the benefit of their wisdom, but the entire department behind them. It's not easy for many of us. It wasn't easy for many of his colleagues to put up with this. He had several who left who complained about Dr. Warwick's little meeting. He's a kind of it's the highway or my way kind of guy. But it's allowed them to deliver a level of care that has made it so they haven't had a single patient die as a teenager in the last 11 years, something almost no program in the country can claim. When you start seeing the implications of how performance, using the knowledge we already have out there, can change what our results actually are, you start to see deeper implications. But I hadn't realized it in the course of writing the book until I had a conversation in the operating room. I was doing a case that was going extremely well. It was routine enough that I had the iPod on, playing some music, and I started chatting across the drapes with the anesthesiologist. And the anesthesiologist helping at that moment was a second-year resident named Mark Simon. He was 29 years old. And we just started chatting about, I mentioned this whole cystic fibrosis thing, the bell curve, and how variable the care was, and my puzzling over, you know, what I asked him, I said, what do you think this could be? What do you think could account for all of this, why some places were better than another? And he was distinctly uncomfortable with this whole line of discussion. And then he confessed that he has cystic fibrosis. I was floored. I had no idea. I'd operated with him before, and I'd never known. And then he described to me what it had been like. He had done well through his undergraduate years in college. He did well through most of medical school. And then in his fourth year, he got a pneumonia, a bad exacerbation of his cystic fibrosis, and it landed him in the hospital for a month. The next year, in his first year of residency, he spent 6 weeks in the hospital. This was now halfway through his second year, and he had already spent another month in the hospital. And at the age of 29, he'd become all too acutely aware that the average survival for cystic fibrosis is 33 years. And so our discussion shifted. What we began to talk about was, how do we save his life? How do we make it possible for him to see, to become a geriatric patient? Well, our answer would normally be that he needs a cure. And the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has also bet in that direction. It put most of its investment in trying to support scientists to find a cure for cystic fibrosis. It's what the National Institutes of Health has done. It's what the U.S. government does for health problems that we don't seemingly have solutions to. And in 1989, when the gene for cystic fibrosis was discovered, that was thought to have paid off, because surely a cure would only now be a few years away. But here we are, it's now almost two decades later, and we don't have a cure on the horizon. So where Mark has put his bet is on the idea that we already have the wisdom out there to help him live that long. Because yes, the average survival is 33 years. But there is that one place out there in Minnesota that has used the knowledge we already have and somehow made it so that people could live 47 years. And if collectively we could somehow take the knowledge that was strewn through all of the different centers, perhaps it could be even longer. There is an essay, one of my favorite essays, by two philosophers named Samuel Gorovitz and Alistair MacIntyre, and it's on the nature of fallibility. And what they pointed out was that there are, in essence, only two main reasons why people are fallible, why we have failure. One reason is ignorance, meaning that we have a general lack of knowledge about the particulars of how the world really works. But a second source of failure is ineptitude, as they called it, meaning that the knowledge is there, but an individual fails to apply it correctly. Well, the revolution of our world now, in a way that's different from all the centuries of human history before, is that ineptitude is as much our difficulty as ignorance. You go back to 60 years, and the major reason that people didn't get to live a full life, didn't have the opportunities to make it to 80 as the average person does now, and be actually more productive than ever before in history, more capable. The reasons they didn't was because of ignorance. We didn't know how to treat heart disease. We didn't know how to prevent it. We didn't know how to take care of high blood pressure, how to stop strokes, how to treat many infectious diseases. But look at where we are today. We have 6,600 different drugs. We have thousands of surgical treatments. We have hundreds of ways to make diagnoses. And so the challenge is that we have this vast edifice of scientific knowledge and ability and skill, and somehow we have to get it to the individual everywhere. And there's a gap, a performance gap, between what we know and what we actually do. So what our struggle is ineptitude, or the nice way to put it is performance. Trying to grasp, what is it that can let you make for better? And the answer turns out to be in those capacities for diligence, for careful surveillance, for bedside ingenuity. Well, the other thought about this is that there are lessons then from how medicine overcomes fallibility for all of us. My hope then, in thinking through these ideas and trying to tell these stories, is that we might start to discover the ways, just from looking at something as human and complex as medicine, we might discover the ways that all of us can do better. I want to thank you for your time, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions you might have.
Our thanks to Dr. Atul Gawande for his comments this evening. We have a large number of questions, but before we begin, I would like to remind our listeners that this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Dr. Atul Gawande, who's talking about performance and safety in medicine. Lots of questions, and I've sort of grouped them together.
Excellent.
To begin with, what do you think needs to be done in medical schools to teach the attribute of genuine interest, compassion? From the first year of medical school, students are under pressure to know it all and are not very free to acknowledge not knowing. How much do you think this interferes with mastery and mistakes later on? What do you think medical educators can do?
That's a lot of questions rolled up in one, huh? How do we fix those damn medical students? No, I mean, the serious undertone here is, how do you make people have those attributes that the questioner asked about? How do you make them humane and capable and competent? And that is, of course, the entire struggle of the edifice of medical education. The answer is, it doesn't come from book learning. It comes from practice in the real world. It comes from seeing models of other people who take you under their wing and show you what it means to actually be humane and competent at the same time. Because, there's certain realms of ideas and realms of knowledge that only come to you by sort of following models and getting the human experience of it. And that's been the hard part about medical education. People have been changing medical education to get the students into sitting down with patients, seeing them much earlier, developing relationships. And that's been a really smart direction. The other thing is that, I think we underestimate the sense in which students coming through are humane. What they feel more than anything is compassion for the people they're taking care of. They're afraid they're going to hurt them, afraid that they'll never become someone who can actually take real responsibility for the lives of other people. And that transformative process comes from partly just learning the language of, how do you put names on disease? How do you pick out the problems? How do you understand the pharmacology of all these drugs? And you start to lose yourself in the details of the knowledge you have to master. But then it all comes together when you're sitting in a clinic with a patient who has a problem and you're trying to figure out, how do we work together to access all of that science and know-how that you supposedly have? So the short answer is, I think medical education is doing it at one level. People are coming through today who medical schools that are now more competitive than ever. We have more applicants than ever, and the quality of the people coming through are unbelievable. But the hard part then is, how do you make it possible for them to be comfortable with their fallibility? And the answer there is, we have to be willing to look at our own failures and show the ways that we can do it. It means being willing to measure ourselves at the more senior levels. And if we start doing it, then people at the lower levels begin to be perfectly comfortable themselves.
So how do you recommend we pick a good doctor? How do you know who's at the good side of the bell curve?
We don't know. I struggle with this all the time. People ask me, who should I see? I just got a couple of emails today. Can you tell me a good geriatrician in New York City? And I don't even know how you'd go about really trying to answer that, except the old-fashioned way. You call around, you talk to a few doctors, you know, you ask them, who's good? Who's got a great reputation? But of course, you would have asked around in Cincinnati, and everyone would have said, boy, Cincinnati Children's Hospital is the place you want to be. As a surgeon, I do a lot of cancer surgery, and I would love to know who really are the best in the kinds of operations I do, who have the lowest complication rates, the highest survival rates. And if I knew that, I would go and watch them, and I'd learn from them. Instead, what I know are the people who have great reputations. And what I see are people who sometimes, you know, seem to really deserve their reputation, learn a lot from them. But then others who you really wonder where their reputation came from. In some areas, you can go on the internet. Cystic Fibrosis now, for example, posted all of the results of all of their centers in November in a major experiment to see whether openness actually is better for the profession. And I'm convinced it's an experiment worth watching. For about 3 or 4 years, they have first shared the results among all of the institutions, taking the names off the labels and letting them see who's good and who's not. And then they'd have meetings to share ideas together. And you saw the bell curve begin to move. It started rising higher. Results started to get better. And the bottom in particular started to lift up. So there was even some narrowing of the curve. But there's still always going to be the curve. There are a few places that have a greater capacity for learning and changing more quickly and absorbing things. But that openness and that transparency, we're afraid of it, but it's the direction that I think we have to go.
Continuing along that same line, how do you find the place with the best outcomes? Because a good record may indicate superior treatment, but it may also indicate acceptance only of the least challenging cases.
Yes. It is one of the great criticisms that come in is whether the data is garbage. When you look at any mix of people rating how doctors do, you know it's a mix of sometimes shoddy information, a reputation that somehow is either not founded or it's founded well. But then also we've seen in New York State, for example, that cardiac surgeons are rated there, their information is made public, and there is the, even though you can't seem to find it in the data, people report that sometimes a very sick patient has a hard time finding a doctor who's willing to take care of them because if they died, it would be on their statistics. I want to contrast that a little bit with obstetrics. You know, I think it's a bad sign when we in medicine start saying we don't want to measure and let people know how we're doing because we're going to play with the numbers. In obstetrics, people have been reporting maternal death rates, newborn death rates, and Apgar scores, which rate how healthy a child is on a scale of 1 to 10, for five decades now. And you didn't see people saying, oh, I can't take that unhealthy, complicated pregnant patient into our program because it's going to screw up our statistics. We had made it a commitment for a long part of our history that we were going to make it possible to deliver children anywhere in any hospital that is taking on obstetrics safely with excellent results. And we have a less than 1 in 15,000 death rate for mothers today, where just a couple of generations ago was the most common cause of death for women of childbearing age was childbirth. You could have people playing with the Apgar scores, faking the numbers a little bit, telling you your child is your baby's a 10 instead of a 5 or something like that. But they recognize that here was a powerful tool by rating how a child was doing and looking carefully at the real condition. They could realize the right thing to do for that child. If they had a poor score, that meant that they needed to be intubated, needed to be sent to the neonatal intensive care unit, or you were in danger of losing them. And vice versa, if they had an excellent score, let the mother hold that baby and begin their life together. Well, this is the opportunity we have in other walks of medicine to have the information, to know what our outcomes are like. And we know that sometimes they're complicated. A poor Apgar score can reflect the performance of the team in a child delivery, or a baby that was sick to begin with. But we've accepted the responsibility that, sick or not, we have to do what we can to save everybody. And vice versa. It will take some effort and constant vigilance and professionalism to be willing to use information in the right way. You know, we have earnings reports for businesses, and some places like Enron faked it. But the success of how businesses work depend on having that information be out there, or we wouldn't have any ability to know who's doing well or who's not. And that's kind of like we are where we are now in medicine. We just don't know even how I'm doing.
Well, you mentioned your iPod. And a recent New York Times article stated that you rock in the OR. Given your busy life as a surgeon, writer, and father, how do you find new, interesting, independent music to listen to? And, again, I'm lumping. Could you give three pieces of advice on work habits which have helped you succeed?
I have an easier time telling you where you can get music. One thing you have are good friends, including a guy who's the rock critic for the Washington Post who gives me good advice. And also my homepage on my computer is Pitchfork, which is a great magazine for independent music. But more to that other question of how do you try to... I mean, the other question is about how do you balance trying to live a life where I'm doing surgery every week and trying to write, I have a family, I try to do research. And the answer is I've given up on balance. I am into intensity. But, you know, it's because each of those components in my life are so rewarding that to lose them is giving up more than I would ever want. What would I give up? Would I give up the surgery? Would I give up the family? Would I give up the writing? Just the answer is no way to any of that. And so, yeah, you throw them together and it makes sometimes for a little bit of misery. But I do try to write a little bit every day. I find ways that I've been able to do it also because I have a tremendously supportive wife. Kathleen is someone who has made it so that when I fell behind on this book, we were planning a ski vacation, one of our first. And she saw I was falling behind, and she, as a surprise, rented a house for me on Cape Cod, canceled the ski vacation, and took the kids on her own. And I had a place to myself to try to write. So it takes enormously helpful people who've been around me who make it possible. And then a chance to just try to do it, even though sometimes you fear you might burn out someday.
In a different direction now. Please discuss the differences that processes and systems, as opposed to individual practitioners, make in medical performance, and especially how incentives work or don't work to improve process performance.
That's a confusing question. I guess the question really is...
How much is the system and how much are the individuals?
Yes, okay. Well, so the answer is it's always both. We've kind of been living through a period where people have said the mantra that in order to get better results, you have to understand it's not individuals, it's the systems. And that's true in one level. And then you come to that moment where you are constantly making up for a broken system. I had ordered a CT scan for a patient a couple of days ago, and I needed to make sure that patient got that CT scan without an injection of contrast that they often give to help light all the organs up so you can see them more clearly on the CT. But this was a patient who I needed to make sure did not get that IV contrast because it was going to interfere with a treatment I wanted to give her afterwards. Well, I could write it on the order, and we had a little system in place to make sure it happens. What's the likelihood I could count on that system actually making that happen 100% of the time? You can't. I have to call downstairs, try to get the radiologist on the phone, and make sure that it really does happen. And then that CT scan will be tomorrow, I think. And I'm still not going to bet on it. I have to turn around and try to call again
Don't forget, no IV contrast. Well, we need to be able to fix the systems. Obviously, we can't expect that if we have a system that relies on the individual catching every problem, then we are bound to have a 3 or a 4 or a 5% failure, and we will never get better than that. We have to be able to fix things to make them more simple, more reliable, so you get down to that 1 in 1,000 error rate. But medicine is so complex, and parts of it just don't work well enough, that for people to be great at what they do, you still have to count on individuals who are conscientious enough and attentive to the details to make up for sometimes broken systems. So the incentives you end up needing are, you need ways to reveal that the system doesn't work. I talked about Walter Reed, and what you had were good people trying to make that outpatient care work and failing. And the only way they could have really been helped was if there were people who were actually measuring and asking, how often are our soldiers not getting good care 1 year after they've been saved? They were asking that question about the 48 hours after they were wounded, but not the 12 months after they were wounded. And that was the difference between the fantastic care that made it possible for individuals to become heroes at the bedside, saving their lives, and then other individuals who had every possibility of being heroes to be stymied at every turn.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Dr. Atul Gawande, who's talking about performance in medicine, how we can do better. Another question. Your recent article in the New Yorker mentions the decline of geriatric specialists. Besides intensive training for nurses to assess the elderly in a maintenance manner, how do you propose to educate the patients themselves to seek and demand this type of care?
I wrote an article last week for the New Yorker magazine that I have learned is a little unnerving because it describes all the ways in which our body falls apart as we get older.
My mother loved the article.
And, of course, that process starts a lot earlier than we like to hear in our 20s, even for some parts of our body, 30s and 40s for others. And one of the reasons why I went into such excruciating detail about how your teeth start to age and what happens is your hair roots start to lose their cells is that I wanted people to grasp the difference between recognizing that we are ultimately going to die and having the fantasy we all have that, well, maybe we can somehow live forever. And where it comes down to is the idea of the geriatrician. Does anybody clamor for geriatricians? We've had a drop from 1998 to 2004 in the number of geriatricians in our country by one-third. At a time when the number of elderly are increasing enormously, and just a decade, we're going to be at 20% of the population being over the age of 65. Now, part of the reason people don't clamor for the geriatrician is what the geriatrician does. What the geriatrician does is they don't make your life longer. They help figure out how to be attentive to your nutrition and whether your toenails are clipped and whether you have good balance and whether your strength is there and whether you're exercising and whether your eyes are doing well. All the things that you need in order to stay independent, to have control over your life. And so there was a randomized trial in Minnesota that showed that the likelihood that under geriatrician's care, as opposed to the usual primary physician for these elderly patients, the likelihood that they would have a disability dropped by 25%. The likelihood they developed depression dropped by 50%. But they didn't live any longer. And so what we've had is the gradual disappearance of geriatrics as a profession and almost no outcry about that. If you took away a brand new $25,000 coronary stent, people would be screaming. But we're taking away geriatricians and no one is. And so my answer to what do we do about it? Well, the reasons why geriatricians are disappearing is in part because we don't pay them very well. They're one of the lowest paid professions compared to becoming a radiologist, becoming a surgeon like I am. And another reason is because it's not glamorous work. taking care of older people with lots of different problems, arthritic knees, a tumor they might have developed, a bad back pain, diabetes, high blood pressure, and then somehow helping them live and stay at home as long as possible. But if we value it and we actually demand that it's Congress or insurers that we pay for those things, that our priorities change, then we actually would transform what it's like to age. And I tried to paint a little picture of what it means to take these ideas of performance and better and apply it to something like how we get older. And it showed that there are opportunities on all sides, opportunities for patients, for people who can live lives in an extraordinary way. I tell the story of an 85-year-old who is in fabulous shape, doing very well on her own, but turned out to be at nearly 80% risk that she would fall within the next year and break her hip. And it only took visits to a podiatrist and a couple changes in her medications to make it much less likely that that would happen. I also told of an 87-year-old, a geriatrician himself, who could still drive, who took care of his ailing wife, and could do all of this independently. But I was not going to paint a fantasy for you that they were going to live forever.
In an effort to do better, should we have health care for every citizen?
Absolutely. I was part of the Clinton administration in 93 when we had our health reform debacle, and I've had my shot at it. But we are in worsening shape now than 14 years ago when we failed before, and the case for being able to change our health system, make it possible for everybody to be cared for, is fiercely stronger than ever before. It's reflected in one thing, for example, the number of emergency rooms that we have available to us have reduced dramatically over the last decade because the emergency rooms are where the uninsured go for their care. It's the only place. And so they lose money. So suburban ERs are disappearing. The result is that every minute there is an ambulance circling looking for an emergency room that's actually open because the others are backed up so much that they've gone on divert. My hospital has an average of 2 to 4 hours a day where we close the doors of the emergency room to new patients because we've simply run out of room. And we're a pretty darn well-funded private hospital. That's a reflection of the need now. If we want to change the shape of the bell curve, one of the most important things we could do to lift the bottom up is do something about our insurance disaster.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, but again, I'm going to lump two together. Why are hospital wards so cold, not in decor, but temperature? And how are you going to turn all these stories into a movie?
I have no idea why it's cold. I'm a skinny guy, and I'm freezing all the time in the hospital or in the ORs, and I don't...
I think it's to keep all the doctors awake.
That could be. And it's funny you should ask about turning the stories into a movie. Grey's Anatomy was actually based on my first book, and I didn't even know it until Ellen Pompeo was on
Good Morning. She said it on TV.
She said it on Good Morning America, and I about fell out of my chair. Grey's Anatomy was called Complications until 2 weeks before the show aired. Right. Turned out the title didn't test as well as Grey's Anatomy. And then as I looked into it, there were a bunch of episodes that were indeed based on it. And, you know, I was enormously flattered because the idea of the stories is to show you drama. I don't have as much sex in my books, unfortunately. But there is the drama.
But some does go on at the hospital. We don't have to talk about that here tonight.
Yes. But so I don't know where it goes, but what I love is the idea that people sometimes see the drama in the ideas as well as the ideas in the drama.
It's very true. And do you like Grey's Anatomy?
I do. I watch it. I'm a sucker for
I do too.
For these kinds of shows.
Yeah, I am as well.
It was based on my book. Of course I like it, right?
You should love it. And actually, they all had to read your book before.
It was a signed
reading. It was homework. Okay. Well, our thanks to Dr. Atul Gawande, writer for The New Yorker, assistant professor, Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital, and author of Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Dr. Kim Mulvihill, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. One more.